Hei, og velkommen til Blodig alvor, podcasten for folk med blødersykdom. Til tross for at de fleste barn med hemofili I dag kan leve et ganske normalt liv takket være behandling, det fortsatt visse begrensninger og aktiviteter som ikke anbefales, eller som kanskje bare ikke føles helt riktig. Selv om fotball ok I henhold til anbefalingene, hva skjer med en skikkelig takling for eksempel? Og hva skjer hvis barnet viser seg å ha et stort talent I en idrett og ikke vil noe annet enn å satse? Vil kroppen holde stand? Hvordan man tenker må være opp til hver familie og barn, men kanskje du som lytter kan få litt inspirasjon og veiledning etter å ha hørt dagens episode. Du skal nemlig få høre et intervju med den profesjonelle syklisten Alex Dowsett, hentet fra den svenske versjonen av Blodig alvor. Alex Dowsett I dag den eneste kjente idrettsutøveren med hemofili som har konkurrert på aller høyeste nivå I samme konkurranse som helt friske mennesker. Han har helt nylig lagt sykkelkarrieren på hylla etter å ha vunnet massevis av medaljer I alle store sykkelmesterskap. Nå vil han inspirere flere barn med hemofili til å tørre å satse på idrett.
Hi Alex, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Tell me what you're up to these days.
I just moved countries and moved house, moved countries as well. So it's been quite hectic. But yeah, recently retired from professional cycling. I would still call myself a cyclist, but not at the same level anymore and starting life after professional sport, which has been good fun so far. I've enjoyed it.
And that's why you moved countries as well, because you stopped the professional cycling.
Yeah, we lived in Andorra, and we lived at the top of a whacking great big mountain at 2,000 meters altitude to be training at altitude. And the minute cycling finished, I learned how to ski. I sort of did a winter of skiing, which was good fun. And then moved back to the UK, which is where I'm from, back to near my family and friends. And yeah, it's a new chapter.
You've had a fantastic career as a cyclist. How did it all start?
It is very hemophilia focused. It's like a lot of kids, there was a lot of sports I wasn't allowed to do in school. Football, rugby, the two main ones. And they're two of the main sports in school. And sort of I had this mentality that I wanted to be in sport and I wanted to be good at sport. My father really helped because he would say to me, yeah, unless you try a sport, you're not going to know if you're good at it. And I think deep down, I wanted to be good at sport. And a lot of that comes from the hemophilia, sat on the sidelines, somewhat watching. I was a swimmer. I did some athletics. I sailed dinghies, did some go-karting because my dad was a race car driver. And then started mountain biking with my father. And one of the guys there had a road bike. And I asked him if I could have a go on the road bike because it's not super accessible, and went and did a race and I enjoyed it. It wasn't like a light bulb, like, oh, he's the light bulb moment where I realized this was my sport came a year later, but I enjoyed it. I kept going back, kept getting faster. I think my dad was told once or twice that I had a talent for it, but we didn't really know what that looked like. And then, I was racing against men a lot and doing well, but I was never raced much against kids my own age. And I went to the sort of national championships for under 17s, and I was 14 years old. So I was two years younger than the oldest guys, and finished second overall.
Wow.
The top 10 was all 16 year olds, and then there was one 14 year old sat in second place, and that was kind of the light bulb moment where I was like, oh, right, I'm actually good at this. Mm. I liked it before, and then I started to love it. Because I think, and that was always where it came from. I just loved being good at something. But yeah, I think sort of circling back, it was, I definitely had a head start in cycling because I was swimming so much. And I was swimming because the hemophilia doctors had said swimming was so good for hemophilia. I wasn't very good at swimming. It was good for me, but I wasn't very good at it.
So it wasn't as fun, maybe?
No. I like the social side of it. I'm competitive and we'd race and I would never win. I wouldn't even be close to winning. But so the swimming gave me that fitness So when I did get on a bike, I didn't really have to get fit. And I think I wouldn't have been trying all of these other sports if I could do the sports in school. So I'm very grateful to my haemophilia for providing that sort of impetus, that catalyst, I guess, for cycling. And I'm very confident if it wasn't for my haemophilia, I probably wouldn't be a professional cyclist. Mm. Certainly wouldn't be on this podcast.
For how long have you been doing this now? You started when you were about 14.
I'm 34, so it's 20 years ago.
Wow.
Well, 21 years. Yeah, 21 years I rode my first race. And it's good. I've raced some of the biggest stuff, like Tour de France and World Championships. Just the Olympics was the one I didn't quite get to, which is going to haunt me for the rest of my life. But I did some good stuff otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. You were diagnosed with haemophilia when you were 3 years old, right?
18 months.
18 months, yeah. Okay. Does anyone else in your family have the disease, or are you the first?
No, yeah, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, my mum is a carrier, and my grandfather from my mum's side sadly died before I was diagnosed. They're pretty confident he wasn't a haemophiliac. He got pretty beat up in the war, and he made it out with some kind of quite big injuries. So I'd imagine if he had haemophilia, probably wouldn't have got that far. So yeah, they're pretty sure it starts with my mum. And then I have a 2-year-old daughter, and she's a carrier. So it continues.
It continues, yeah. How did your diagnosis affect your everyday life in your childhood?
Well, I think from the point of view of the haemophiliac, it's not great, but it's kind of, it becomes normal pretty quick. Yeah, you don't know any different. So I'm always of the opinion it affects the family more than it affects the actual haemophiliac in the younger ages, because and yes, the injections they're not great. Like, there's nothing fun about them. It wasn't until I got older that I realized I had something up with me, and there was a bunch of kids that didn't have something up with them, something wrong with them. Not wrong, I don't even like the word wrong, but different maybe. So I always thought it's much tougher on my mum and dad and sister than it was me, because they had to learn about a condition they'd barely heard of. They'd heard of it, but they'd only heard sort of terrible things with, because you're just recently out of the blood contamination scandal. So there's a lot of, when you hear haemophilia, you hear a lot of HIV and hepatitis talk as well, which is pretty scary. And then it's a lot of hospital trips, a lot of wondering what the future is going to hold. And it's, yeah, tough, really tough. But we trod our own path. I think there was, the thing that we decided not to do, we went to one or two, and my mum and dad recall it, they'd go to other parents to learn about like life with haemophilia, and it was just, everyone wanted to share their most negative, everyone wanted to share horror stories, like negative stories. It was all so much negativity. And my mum and dad, bless them, they're brave. They took a step back and went, you know what, we're gonna work this one out for ourselves. We're gonna tread our own path. We definitely took some risks that we perhaps wouldn't have done if we'd gone to all of these doom and gloom sessions. Mm. We never went into these sports. We never disrespected the condition, because we figured like the doctors should be the ones telling us yes or no. And they never really, if we'd gone in and said we want to go do boxing, they'd have gone, absolutely not. But we went in and we said, hey, we want to do dinghy sailing. And they said, yeah, like, that's good. Just head injuries are big. So maybe a helmet. And so I was me and my sister, because my parents didn't want me to be the odd one out, would be the only ones in the sailing club wearing helmets. So we never disrespected the condition.
And how did that affect you think?
Well, I think it was quite inspiring. It was like, my parents were great for not trying to just say no. It's like, if I come home and say, I want to play rugby, instead of saying just like, no, you can't, it would be like, no, you can't, but we'll take you swimming. Or no, you can't, but we'll go to the local go-kart track. Or no, you can't, but we'll join the local dinghy sailing club and try this. And then obviously cycling. Like I started, I think that by that point, when I was 11 and started mountain biking with my dad, like I was a kid that rode my bike, like all kids do. Fell off once or twice, but always had a helmet on. And then when cycling was starting to get a bit more serious and road based, we said to the doctors, look, this cycling thing seems to be a possible avenue. What do you think? And the doctor sat there and just said, we'd prefer it if you played chess or a musical instrument. But if that's what you want to do, we'll support you. We're not going to stop you. And this is the thing, when it came down to the cycling, and it was a question I had in a talk in Portugal. It really threw me. A doctor in Portugal who, there was an audience question to the crowd, and she said, I think it's deeply irresponsible what you've done. And I was like, whoa, okay. She said, it's a dangerous sport. And I was thrown. Luckily, I had it was myself and my own consultant who were there just by coincidence. Like, he was the consultant that the charity or the company putting on the conference wanted, and then they wanted me as well. And he interjected. He said, if I can answer, sure. Alex falls off, right? And we've repaired a few broken bones, and there's been a few cuts and scrapes and bruises. Let's talk about the Alex that doesn't race a bicycle. I weigh 75 kilos, which equates to 2,000 units of factor VIII every second day. And he said, if Alex wasn't a cyclist, because I think the lady also brought up cost, like cost to healthcare systems from when I break bones.
Okay, that was the irresponsible part, or?
That and the message, just the whole thing.
Yeah.
The cost and the message it sends out, what if a load of kids like start road cycling? He said, let's talk about the Alex that doesn't race a bike. He's 85 kilos, not 75, because he's not exercising as a job. Like, literally, my office is to go out and ride 5 or 6 hours and be as light as I can be. And actually, to be as healthy as I can be is my job, or was up until October last year. He said, so the Alex that doesn't cycle is probably 85 kilos, like probably fighting a bit of weight like most of us are, and needs 3,000 units of factor VIII every second day. So that's an additional cost. He says, I wouldn't mind betting that the poor bones we've had to break, the cost of that doesn't scratch the surface on the cost of Alex being unfit and 10 kilos heavier and all of the actual bleeding episodes that could happen as a result of that. He said, so I actually think what Alex has done is quite responsible. It's testament to the how important being healthy, fit and healthy, and having strong muscles, strong joints is. From an exercise point of view, cycling is great because it's low impact. It is low impact until you hit the floor because you've fallen off. It's quite high. It's quite high impact. But it's.
But how often did that happen? That you've fallen off? Is it every week or once a month year?
By the end of my career, I got very good at not crashing. I did a 2.5 year stint with no crashes, which then started to scare me because I was like, sort of superstitious. I was like, I'm due a crash now. It's been too long. One crash a year would be the average.
Okay.
One or two. In the most part, you take skin. You just sort of a bit of skin off on your side, elbows. I broke collarbone, shoulder blade, elbow, thumb, and a couple of ribs. And I didn't know I broke the ribs until months later on. When they scanned me for something else, they asked when I broke my ribs, and I was
I did.
No, I did well in that respect. And I think, again, where hemophilia has changed, when I was a kid, the doctors would say, if I was to break a bone, I'd be in hospital for a month to control the bleeding. That used to scare me. It used to really scare me. And because I knew collarbones, cyclists and collarbones was the one. And in 2010, I was racing in Holland, and halfway through the race, we take a bag with food in, like with energy food and energy drink. And I took the bag a bit wrong, and it fell into my front wheel and popped me over the handlebars. And I went to get up, put my hand on the floor to sort of lift myself up on the floor. And I had a lot of pain going through my shoulder blade. And I was like, "Well, it's a little more serious this than just a bit of skin." So laid back down, hospital, broken shoulder blade. They said I'd broken it well because I didn't need any surgery. I was terrified because I was like, not because of spending a month in hospital or my health, because I had European under 23 European Championships in 8 weeks after that collarbone break. Seven or 8 weeks. And I was like, but the London hospital sent me home pretty quick. They were just like, a bit more medication than normal. Instead of every second day, take it every day for 2 weeks and then you can go back to every second day. I was like, okay. I was like, what can I do? They're like, we'll rest it. After 7 days after the crash, I got on my bike indoors. And then 12 days after the crash, I started riding outdoors, not under the recommendation of any doctors. I just had European Championships looming. I'm terrible for if someone says I can't do something, I'm going to go out there and show them I can. It's quite irresponsible in some respects, but it's helped in others. And when I was going in for a checkup on my shoulder blade, a nurse that she's a pediatric nurse, so she usually works with children. And I knew this because she spoke to me like I was a child. I said, what can I do? And she said, oh, nothing, you need to rest it. I said, okay, but I've got European Championships in like 6 weeks now. And she said, oh, yeah, you won't be doing that. I said, well, I need to, and I need to train for it. And she said, no, you won't be doing that. I was like, well, I'll show you. Yeah, went to European Championships, won it. It's on paper, it's not the biggest result of my career. But I think for me, it possibly is because of the circumstances around it. Oh, it's funny because on the podium, all I could think about was that month in hospital that I should have had, or that like the previous, 10, 15 years ago, I would have had, and the nurse telling me that I wouldn't even be competing.
But was it a big struggle for you? Like, were you in pain the whole time? Or
as long as I had my medication, bleeding was under control. And I think the general rule of thumb with sort of modern day physios, if it doesn't hurt, you're good. Like, don't do anything that hurts. As a cyclist, the shoulder blade's good because it doesn't affect you if you put all your weight on your hands out in front of you. So you could not a press up, but you could do a plank with a broken shoulder blade, but you couldn't do it with a broken collarbone. So actually holding myself on the handlebars of the bike was pain-free. So I was like, well, if it's pain-free, then it's not doing me any damage. So I'm going to do it. I mean, my doctor, when I did go in 2 weeks after the crash, my Dr. Dan was like, are you riding? I was like, yeah. He's like, are you riding on the road outside? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay. He's like, I'm not going to tell you not to, but you do know if you crash again, you're going to be in real trouble. I was like, yeah.
That was the big risk. That was a big risk. Not really you, it was, not healing.
Yeah, crashing again. And it was on the back of my mind. I rode very carefully. Yeah, probably not my most responsible moment, but...
But you won, right?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I'd do it again.
How did you prepare for a race with regards to your treatments? Did you at all?
Well, I think the most frustrating part of it all was having to take the treatment with me. I mean, the races are all international. So, the long ones, we call them the Grand Tours, which is like the Tour de France. There's also one in Italy and there's one in Spain as well. I'd have to take 3 weeks worth of treatment with me, like in my hand luggage. So, I had to do it, but it was normal, but it was a bit frustrating. If my treatment would be every second day, I would make sure that on race day was a treatment day. So I might miss a day. Like my treatment plan was very much catered around risk. So if I'd be training Monday, Tuesday, but having a rest day Wednesday, I'd take my medication Monday. That'd cover me for Monday, Tuesday. And then if I was racing Thursday, I wouldn't have any on Wednesday because there's no risk. So pretty much we sat on the sofa all day on a rest day. And then I'd have it Thursday morning because the race would be like higher risk as well.
And talking about treatments, how was your treatment during childhood? Was it also every second day or how did it?
Well, you probably can split it into two parts. First part was up to the age of 10 or 11 where it was reactive. So I'd have an internal bleed. I wouldn't have any treatment. And then when I had a bleeding episode, I would then have treatment. And then, at 12, they put me on to prophylaxis treatment, which I think was 1,000 or 1,500 units every second day initially. And then when I got bigger and heavier, it went up to 2,000 units. Yeah.
So you just got your treatment on demand as a child. Did that affect your joints? Do you have any problems with your joints and so today?
Yes, but not much. I've got an elbow and an ankle. In my elbow is just limited range of movement, which doesn't, I barely notice it. If I have to put on a tie, which is quite rare as someone that wears active sportswear every day.
You might be doing it more now.
Might be doing it more now.
You never
know. It'd have to be a clip-on job. An ankle, which didn't really give me any trouble during my career, but I'm running, doing a bit of running now, running the London Marathon on Sunday, like this Sunday coming. My ankle has not liked running much. That's been, I've had to manage it and sort of work on it slowly, but it's been pretty good. It's actually improving. I met once with he's a former World Hemophilia Association. And he asked that question to me. He's like, have you got any problems with joints? I was like, oh yeah, I've got an elbow that doesn't bend properly and an ankle. And then I made the mistake of asking him if he had any, and it was quite the list. I was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, there's nothing wrong. I'm fine.
But he was a bit older then.
Quite a bit older, yeah. And it certainly gave me a lot of perspective. And I think, what's nice is talk to the young haemophiliacs now, and it's different because they've never experienced an internal bleed, which in a way presents new problems. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's great, but suddenly they've got this condition which they have to have either a portacath or injections for. They've never actually experienced the symptoms, I guess, of the condition. It's like blood test has told them they have haemophilia, but it's managed. I think that's tough for a kid, because then I knew exactly why I couldn't play rugby, because I would have a sore ankle or a sore elbow or a sore knee. I would have these bleeding episodes. It'd be like, even if you said go on to that rugby pitch, I'm on crutches. I can't do that. But now you've got these youngsters who have the same condition I do, but do not, they've not experienced the downsides to it. So I'd imagine it's going to be tougher to say to them, you can't be on a rugby pitch or in a boxing ring or whatever they want to do. Like, there is limitations, but yeah, the good outweighs the bad.
You told me that you always had like a lot of luggage with you, like in the hand luggage, all your treatments when you're going to different races and stuff. Do you have any thoughts about upcoming treatments, such as like gene therapy or something that wouldn't require so much stuff?
Yes, I think I haven't had a checkup since I stopped cycling. I'm due one very soon, I think. So it's not a conversation I've had with my consultants. I know whilst I've been racing, we've been of the opinion that if it's not broke, we're not going to fix it. What we've been doing has worked, and we don't really want to change anything. I know there's treatments that are longer lasting than what I've been taking. So I think there's a conversation to be had there. Yeah, and the gene therapy one is interesting. I asked my doctor about it, just how it's going for the trial patients. And he said for haemophilia B, it's great. It's perfect. For haemophilia A, which I have, it's a little more complicated.
Has your haemophilia ever been in the way of your cycling? I know you already talk about the big luggage, hand luggage you need to take everywhere, but
no, it's been nice actually. I had a mum a talk once said, "What does your team do when you crash?" And it's a when question. It's not an if. And I said, "Well, okay, if I can get up and carry on, like if I've just cut some bruises, then I will. And if I can't, then I need to go to hospital." They said, right, so pretty much the same as everyone else in the team. And I said, yeah. I said, hospital's going to panic when I arrive, but otherwise, no different to anyone else on the team. To this mum of a newly diagnosed haemophiliac, she was like, right, so you're in quite a dangerous sport and you are being treated no differently to any of your teammates. And I said, no, I guess not. She says, right, then why should my son be treated any differently at school? And I said, I can see that. And I think that was a super important message that came from my cycling career.
You've set up an organization called Little Bleeders, right?
Yeah.
And it aims to encourage children with bleeding disorders to engage in sports, like especially cycling and swimming. Why did you do this?
Yeah, so an opportunity arose when I was sort of 24 with the large pharmaceutical company to travel around Europe with a campaign that we called Miles for Haemophilia to talk about my story. The good thing is the pharmaceutical company, from their point of view, and I know they get a bad rep in a lot of ways, but for me, they wanted to encourage a healthy lifestyle, which if you think about it, the knock-on effect to that is actually less medication sold, because less problems. So in my eyes, that was a good thing. So we traveled around, talked, you know, visited multiple countries, went to Stockholm, talked there. Yeah, Finland, Portugal, Spain, Germany, Austria. Yeah, all over. And I knew in the haemophilia world that I was a little bit unique, but I didn't realize how unique, for one. And then I didn't realize the power of my story to provide a best case scenario when there's so many worst case scenarios. I thought about the family meetings that my parents decided not to go to because it was doom and gloom. And I was like, I'm now providing exactly what they needed in 1990. My manager and I at the time, he was like my manager for cycling teams and stuff, but I was always like, I want to do more. So we said, what can we do? And it was like the obvious one was start up an organization, a charity. In the first few years, we were focused like on policy change in government and stuff, which was fine. Like we did some good stuff, but it wasn't really what I wanted us to be doing. And then in the last couple of years, we've really changed direction and created the sports fund, which has been very well timed in light of we have a cost of living crisis here in the UK. So a lot of family, and for young haemophiliacs, a lot of the sports that are good for young haemophiliacs are extracurricular. They cost, they're after school clubs and they cost money. And a lot of the families that want to take their kids to these extracurricular, like gymnastics classes, dance classes, swimming, cycling, they can't because it costs money. So we provide we've had some generous donors. I've used my platform to raise a lot of money for Little Bleeders as well. I did a world record attempt, failed a world record attempt 2 years ago, but we didn't fail because we raised, £55,000, which I guess would be about 70,000 euros in for that, which was massive. And the amount of families that can support now is colossal. It's a really good thing. My fiance, Chanel and I run it. We've got a bunch of phenomenal trustees and it's great.
And do you encourage any sports that kids want to do, or do you have like some restrictions on what you will fund?
That's not a problem we've had to face just yet. No one has applied asking to go to extra rugby lessons. Or it's interesting sometimes how geographical it can be as well. So when I was a kid, my parents asked about skiing holidays. My dad used to ski. Mum, not so much of a fan, but dad used to ski. And the doctors were like, we're not keen. Like, knee injuries are pretty commonplace and stuff. So we're not. And that's where the element of respect came in. If with the doctors, if they advised something and you went against it, you felt like you're disrespecting them. And they work so hard. So skiing was off the table. And that was fine. Because in the UK, we have to travel to go skiing. But I was in Norway in November talking about skiing. And it was obviously a room full of parents and youngsters with haemophilia. And all like skiing. Like, we basically ski to school. Everyone skis in Norway. You can't tell anyone in Norway not to ski. I was like, okay. So it's funny how it's geographical in that sense. And I skied this winter. And
yeah, did that inspire you to start skiing maybe, or...?
I enjoyed it. I opened my eyes. I hurt myself. I got too confident too quickly and hurt myself.
Have you ever thought about what life choices you would have made if your parents were more cautious with you as a kid, if they didn't have this approach to haemophilia and that they had?
I don't know, because I never felt like I made any decisions, but I never felt like they did either. I always felt like it was joint. We handled haemophilia as a team all the time. Growing older, sort of, and being a parent myself makes me, I think, a lot more of the way my parents handled my haemophilia and how hard it must have been at times. And everything's worked out pretty good. Mm. So I wouldn't have changed anything.
What has the cycling given you in terms of experience and life lessons, would you say? I mean, you led a fantastic life, you said, a couple of times.
No, it's been great. It's been great. I've done everything that 8-year-old Alex would have wanted. You know, I was one of the best in the world. And on paper, I finished 5th in the world championships. It's like I was in 2019, the 5th best in the world at what I do. I think if you told 8-year-old Alex that was going to happen, he'd have been real proud. I don't think I'd have met my other half without cycling. So I don't think I'd have met my other half without haemophilia. You know, a little girl who I share something with, and that she's a carrier and I have it. And we're going to have to tell her about that one day. Just real proud of the way it panned out. You know, both my parents and proud of myself, because I think it could easily have gone in a different direction. And we came at it with always the mindset is like, we know what we can't do, but let's go and find out what we can do. And I think that was the best thing we could have done. So I wouldn't change a thing. In terms of life experiences, it's been, traveled the world. I've seen, it's fun with races. You go to places that you just would never go as a tourist. It's been mad, but in terms of life experiences, it's like it's vast. And now I am retired in the sense that I've finished one career path and starting another. But it's very odd. And a lot of my friends, the same age, still feel like they're just getting going. And I'm like, well, I'm done. I'm starting again. It's great.
Do you have any plans? What will you do now?
I mean, we've got, little bleeders. We want to just keep building on that. That's, I've talked about that. We just want to keep doing what we're doing and keep trying to do it better. And we're still going to continue working within cycling. I, as a cyclist, I formed quite a good reputation for being quite good with the technical aspect of going faster. So working with a clothing brand on that, called No Pins, which is good fun. Helping a team of under 19s. Just spending a bit more time at home, not being on a plane as much as I used to be. I mean, my daughter's, she's 2 years and 3 months old, and she's been on well over 60 flights, and that includes COVID times. Like, it's staggering. So we're hoping to, and that doesn't hold a candle to the amount that I've been on. So we're hoping to bring that number down a bit and just enjoy being at home.
You told me your daughter is a carrier. And we know that carriers can also be affected by bleeding symptoms, depending on the individual factor levels. What is your advice to her for the future?
Listen to the doctors, respect what they say, and respect the condition, but don't let it control your life. Be open-minded that it could be a great thing that happens rather than a burden. And just, every year that goes forwards, it becomes a better environment for a haemophiliac. Like, we touched upon that earlier. So I don't think it's very easy to say to a youngster, oh, you're so lucky because you're born here, but they don't care. They're not going to care about that until they're in their sort of late 20s or 30s. So there's a lot of opportunity.
What are your hopes for the future when it comes to the haemophilia treatment and so on?
Yeah, we want to strive towards a place where there is no haemophilia. I think ultimately, I mean, I know it served me well, but there's, for every one of me, there's so many that are not having the same, having a much tougher time. Let's not beat around the bush. Without the medication, haemophilia is a diabolical place to be. condition to have. So I think that's what I hope for the future, that it doesn't become, that haemophilia doesn't continue to be a kind of disease where your country of residence defines the level of care you get. That's had me in tears at times when I had a dad of a haemophiliac message me, and he was like, what can I do to like help my son have the best opportunities? And he was from Ukraine. This was like way back, so obviously way before everything has started in Ukraine now. And I was like, yeah, just get him swimming a lot, like I did, and just keep on top of your medication. He was like, oh, I have to drive. If my son gets a bleed, I have to drive 4 hours to the hospital to get one dose of medication. I was like, an 8-hour round trip for something that I have a stockpile of in my fridge just because you were born in Ukraine and I was born in the UK. That's not fair. So many don't have the same access to it. And that's what I hope for.
Thank you so much for sharing your great story, showing that you can reach the very top and your dreams despite a haemophilia diagnosis. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been real good.
Det var historien til tidligere proffsyklist Alex Dowsett, intervjuet av Johanna Pauses Darlington. Og jeg har fått med meg fysioterapeut Kristoffer Vemøy nå for en liten debrief. Og du, Kristoffer, du jobber med blødere.
Helt riktig.
Hva tenker du om historien som Alex forteller?
Jeg synes jo det først og fremst ganske kult. Kanskje litt flaks. Vanskelig å si. Han satsa jo kanskje på idrett i en periode der, ikke sant, man gikk fra å ikke ha tilgang på forebyggende behandling til å få det, da. Så jeg vil jo tro at han har på en måte vært litt, han har vært litt sånn cowboy, da, eller tørt å ta noen risikoer, da.
Mm. Når du sier flaks, hva tenker du på da?
Nei, det jo først og fremst at han kanskje ikke har hatt så mange sånne store blødninger, da. Sånn som han fremstiller det på intervjuet som jeg hørte, og kanskje han har en sånn god blødningsfenotyp, da, som vi kaller det. Det vil ja, si at han kanskje ikke har så høy risiko for det, men han startet jo ikke da med profylakse, da, eller medisin, før han var en 11-12 års alder, så... Og så har han nok hatt familie som kanskje har vært flinke til å si ja, da, og ikke si nei, og har på en måte oppfordret til aktivitet. Og det tror jeg med på en måte fasilitere hans opplevelse av å vokse opp med blødersykdom. Da.
Mm. Alex, han har jo tross alt følt seg veldig bra, både under oppveksten og i årene som profesjonell syklist, til tross for at han har presset kroppen sin på veldig mange måter. Er det uvanlig for noen som har hemofilidiagnose, eller er det noe vi kan forvente i disse dager?
Jeg synes det et godt spørsmål det du stiller, og jeg har ikke noen god fasit på det, men det å skulle bli en toppidrettsutøver og drive med idrett, det jo en prosess som for de fleste tror jeg skjer ganske naturlig. Det starter jo gjerne med på en måte bare lek da, i barneårene, og etter hvert som man vokser opp, så hvis man fortsetter å ha den store interessen, så tilspisses jo også på en måte konkurransen etter hvert, og da det på en måte en sånn naturlig overgang gjerne. Da. Og så det jo sånn at den treningsmengden som på en måte han har lagt ned, det jo ikke noe som har skjedd over et par dager, et par uker eller et år. Han har jo brukt på en måte hele livet sitt på det, da. Så kroppen hans har nok på en måte naturligvis rustet seg opp med årene som han har drivet og syklet, da.
Det jo noen sporter man kanskje skal unngå, kanskje kampsport og den type idretter som har en større risiko. Men så det en høy med idretter som litt mer uklart, som for eksempel sykkel. Hva skal man tenke på når man skal velge en idrett?
Jeg tror det viktigste først og fremst å finne noe som gøy. Absolutt nummer én, viktigste. Som fra et faglig standpunkt så følger vi våre guidelines med det som rett og galt. Og som fysioterapeut så pleier jeg ofte å følge litt med på hva som vurderes som på en måte sånn high impact, low impact idretter da, altså risikoen for å kunne få en skade, hvor mye energi og krefter som i spill, men det jo ganske vanskelig å definere, fordi idretter så mangt, det består av mange ulike faktorer. Og du kan jo si, sånn som med Alex, da, at det å sykle jo ikke nødvendigvis definert som high impact, ikke sant, selve syklingen, men hvis han krasjer, så det jo, kan det jo få store konsekvenser, da.
Mm.
Jeg tror, hvis jeg skulle gitt et godt råd der, så tror jeg det viktig å vite litt sånn at det ligger i vår menneskelige natur at vi ikke har lyst til å skade oss. Og Alex har jo trent på dette her hele livet, ikke sant? Og det idretten og den treningen han har gjort gjør at han blir på en måte motorisk sterkere og mer koordinert, og det også igjen vil jo minimere på en måte risikoen for at han skader seg da. Desto flinkere han blir å sykle, desto mindre sannsynlighet det for at han tryner på sykkelen på en måte.
Mm.
Og hvis vi ser sånn generelt sett på befolkningen, så det ganske få mennesker som skader seg løpet av et år. Hvis vi ser på sånn fra Folkehelseinstituttet, så det vel omtrent 12% av befolkningen som på en måte drar til en lege da, i løpet av et år, og av de igjen så det over halvparten som slipper unna sykehus og operasjoner og sånn, så det ganske få mennesker sånn generelt som skader seg da.
Mm. Mm. Alex Dowsett, han ble jo så god at han gjorde en karriere ut av idretten han begynte på. Og det gikk jo bra for han, men sånn generelt sett, det en god idé å satse på proffidrett når man blødder?
Toppidrett kan man jo diskutere litt om det sunt. Og det gjelder jo ikke bare om man har en blødesykdom eller ei. Toppidrett jo, hvis vi ser på idrettsutøvere som har drevet med toppidrett hele livet, så har jo de pushet kroppen sin veldig hardt. Så sånn for at faglig ståsted, da, så vet jo jeg på en måte at jeg har skiutøvere, de kan få hjertekarproblemer, astma, det er vanlig å få type slitage, artrose, ikke sant, i hofter og knær og korsbånd som ryker, og så hvis jeg ser på det sånn, så jo ikke toppidrett nødvendigvis sunt, men jeg tror det noe med å heller ha fokus på den gleden idrett gir, da. Ja.
Mm. Kan helsevesenet være til hjelp på noen måter hvis en pasient som du vet har en slags sportslig ambisjon da? Kan helsevesenet støtte opp om de?
Absolutt. Det jo vi helsepersonell som på en måte setter standarden for hva som greit og ikke greit. Og vi jo litt som domstolen på en måte. Og det jeg sier skal være basert på sannhet og det jo litt bindende da, for det menneske som på en måte mottar mine ord. Og det jeg sier kan være helsebringende, men det kan også være med på å skape skade på en måte da. Så jeg tror det veldig viktig at vi tenker over det da i møte med pasientene våre, så særlig også sånn som med bløderne da, som jeg treffer når jeg på jobb da.
Mm. Vi snakket litt, eller du nevnte det litt i starten med at Alex kanskje hadde vært litt heldig som ikke hadde opplevd en stor blødning. Og det spekuleres jo litt i om det vanskeligere for dagens unge, fordi de kanskje ikke har opplevd en sånn stor blødning. Hva tenker du om det?
Det jo litt sånn todelt svar til det, fordi det at de ikke har opplevd en blødning jo kanskje egentlig bare positivt, og det jo det vi ønsker da med denne behandlingen vi gir, at de skal få slippe unna blødninger og potensielle senskader på sikt. Det rent psykiske med det, så kan man jo si at ja, kanskje det oppleves mer ille hvis man først får en blødning. Ikke sant? Den ene gangen man får det, så oppleves det mer ille, men det vi ser i hvert fall av de bløderne jeg treffer på jobb og får høre, jo at disse blødningene ofte jo små da, så den behandlingen vi gir, den fungerer, og oppstår en blødning, så hjelper det å sette medisin, og den medisinen gjør ofte at disse blødningene blir så store da. Mm.
Hvis man da i en idrett oppleve en blødning, hva er viktig å gjøre i tiden etter da?
Da håper jeg at vedkommende har hørt fra oss at det lurt å sette medisin hvis man mistenker blødning. Og ellers er det jo på en måte å få ned hevelsen, la smertene roe seg, og så gradvis komme i gang inn etter det da.
Mm. Til slutt, har du noen oppmuntrende ord å sende til foreldre som har barn med hemofili, som kanskje hører på dette og skal veilede sitt barn gjennom en idrett?
Ja, jeg tenker det viktigste er å prøve å være gode forbilder for barna våre, og ikke være redd for å teste ut ulike aktiviteter og idretter, og la leken og på en måte det som er gøy være fokus, og ikke la prestasjonene og forventningspresset være det som styrer valget av idrett, da. Så tror jeg sånn generelt at fysisk aktivitet, særlig i barne- og ungdomsårene, er på en måte den måten vi lærer å kjenne vår egen kropp på, ikke sant? Man tester jo grensene sine litt når man driver med idrett, og det tror jeg er ekstra viktig hvis man har da en kronisk sykdom, eller som man skal vokse opp med da. Så en ting er å bli kjent med sin egen kropp, men du skal også bli kjent med den blødersykdommen du kanskje har da.
Mm. Takk Kristoffer for at du ville dele din kunnskap med oss i dag.
Bare hyggelig.
Takk også til Alex Dosett som ble intervjuet av Johanna Pauses Darlington i den svenske utgaven av Blodig Alvor. Denne episoden er produsert av Vrang Produksjon for CSL Behring. Mitt navn er Synne Hellevang. Flere episoder finner du på www.blodig-alvor.no. Takk for følget.